From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the impact of the Holocaust on the politics and identity of Israel. We talk with Israeli journalist Tom Segev. His new book argues that some Israelis have learned the wrong lesson from the Holocaust. They use the Holocaust to encourage Israeli chauvinism and aggression. Also today, James Foley talks with us about directing the screen version of David Mamet's Pulitzer Prize-winning play Glengarry Glen Ross. The film stars Jack Lemmon, Alan Arkin, and Al Pacino, and it's now out on video. And film critic Stephen Schiff returns with a review of Cliffhanger, the new Sylvester Stallone movie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton's deficit-cutting tax package is being debated by the House of Representatives. After a long night of negotiating, Democratic leaders are confident they have the votes to give the president a much-needed victory. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Today's vote is expected to give the president a boost after the defeat of his economic stimulus package, publicity over his $200 haircut, and the firing and rehiring of his White House travel staff. House Speaker Tom Foley said today that members know how important this vote is to the president and to the economy. A late-night compromise won over a number of conservative Democrats who were demanding stricter controls over spending on mandatory benefit programs such as Medicare and Social Security. The vote may have been postponed without their support. If Democrats prevail, the House will pass a measure that includes a historic tax increase, $250 billion of increases on the wealthy, corporations, upper-income Social Security recipients, and energy users. No Republican is expected to vote for the bill. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Canada's lower house of parliament has approved the treaty that would lower trade barriers among Canada, the United States, and Mexico. The ruling Conservative Party used its 10-vote majority to cut off debate on the issue and put it through on a vote of 140 to 124. The measure now goes to the Conservative-dominated Senate, where passage is regarded as a formality. Critics say the agreement should not be passed until there have been side deals protecting jobs and the environment. At the United Nations, Dante Caputo, the special representative in charge of resolving the political crisis in Haiti, said today that he wouldn't return to that country until the military regime meets a series of conditions. Caputo also called for the international community to impose economic sanctions on Haiti. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
Caputo said he saw no willingness on the part of Haiti's military regime to reach a solution. He said he was unable, by words alone, to convince the regime of the need for a return to democracy. As a result, he said more stringent economic sanctions should be imposed by the international community and the U.S.
This is the time to show that the reality exists, that 2 plus 2 makes 4. And we cannot, you know, go around just looking for dilatory tactics all the time.
Caputo said that while talks could continue, he wouldn't be a part of them until the regime gives him 3 commitments, that it's sincere about a return to democracy, the return of ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and a timetable to implement a lasting solution. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 15 points today to close at a record 3,555. Declines edged advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. At least 5 people were killed and 26 injured today when a car bomb exploded in downtown Florence, Italy. The bomb went off in front of the Uffizi Gallery, destroying works of art and causing extensive damage to the museum. The bomb went off just after 1 o'clock in the morning. Police say they have no leads in the case, but are looking into a possible connection with a bombing earlier this month in Rome. That bombing has been linked to the mafia. The Mexican government is offering a $5 million reward for information leading to the arrest of those responsible for Monday's bloody shootout at the Guadalajara airport. Bibi Kraus reports from Mexico City.
Mexico's attorney general is putting the blame for Monday's shootout on one of the country's most notorious drug families, the Tijuana-based Arellano Felix brothers. According to authorities, the Arellano Felix family hired a 15-man hit squad to assassinate a rival trafficker, Sinaloa-based Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. The hit was allegedly retaliation for an attack by Guzman on a Puerto Vallarta disco last November. Instead, the hitman pumped more than a dozen bullets into Cardinal Juan Posadas Ocampo. Apparently, they mistook the Cardinal's car for that of the Capo Guzman. The Cardinal used a white Grand Marquis sedan, the same car used by many Mexican drug traffickers. Four of the suspect shooters are in custody, and one of them admitted he was offered $10,000 to make the hit on Guzman. For National Public Radio, this is B.B. Krause in Mexico City.
A 21-year-old Navy man was sentenced to life in prison today for the murder of a homosexual shipmate. Prosecutors said that Terry Helvey stalked and killed Alan Schindler because he hated homosexuals. Witnesses at the trial testified that Helvey often denounced gay people and talked about beating them up. The defense said that Helvey suffered severe mental and physical abuse as a child. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. is attracting visitors from around the world. What are the lessons of the Holocaust? My guest Tom Segev says that in Israel, conflicting interpretations of the Holocaust are at the center of a fierce struggle over the politics, ideology, and morals of the present. Segev is the author of the new book, The Seventh Million, about how the Holocaust has influenced the politics and identity of Israel. His book is a controversial bestseller in Israel and has just been published in the United States. Segev writes a weekly column on politics and human rights for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. He's also the author of Soldiers of Evil, a study of commanders of Nazi concentration camps. This weekend, Segev plans to visit the Holocaust Museum in Washington. In his new book, he writes that the Holocaust has become the civic religion of Israel.
It has really become the source where Israelis take elements of their national identity. And this is something secular Israelis need more than religious Israelis do, because religious Israelis have religion. What do you do if you need some link to Jewish history and you're not religious? Many people take the avenue of the Holocaust. And today the Holocaust is very, very much important to many Israelis, and it's increasingly more important all the time. And that's interesting, because the more time passes from the Holocaust, the more the Holocaust moves forward in our collective awareness.
You think that some Israelis have learned the wrong lessons from the Holocaust. What do you think are the wrong lessons?
The major wrong lesson is that the only thing the Holocaust teaches us is that the whole world is against us, and that Israel must be strong enough or very strong. And I think the right lessons are, in addition to that, that the Holocaust summons us to protect democracy and human rights and fight racism, and in the specific Israeli context also, that when an Israeli soldier gets in manifestly illegal order in the army, he should not obey it. I think the Holocaust has humanistic lessons and universal lessons, which we have not yet learned. And we are learning them, but we have not yet learned them. I think the wrong lessons of the Holocaust is taking it to teach us nationalism, chauvinism. That's about it.
Well, you think the Holocaust is even used to justify aggression and to justify the occupied territories?
Very often, yes, very often. It is also taken to justify opposite views, which I also don't like. You see, there is a great deal of politicization of the Holocaust in Israel. This has always been the case, and basically that's a legitimate thing. It is a legitimate thing to draw political lessons from the Holocaust. The question is only what kind of lessons you take. It is also very difficult to distinguish when Israelis are expressing genuine feelings about the Holocaust and when they manipulate the Holocaust. That's something which is very difficult to distinguish, and this is all part of a very interesting argument that's going on in Israel right now, and that's an argument over the politics of memory. How do we shape memory? How the collective memory, and that involves, of course, the question of what lessons do we draw from the Holocaust? It's basically a political argument, which is something many people don't like to hear, because the Holocaust is supposed to be a unifying factor above politics, but it is not. Memory is a political issue.
The Holocaust Museum recently opened here in the United States. Israel has a monument to the victims of the Holocaust, the Yad Vashem. What are your thoughts on that monument?
Well, I think it is also changing, but when it opened in the 50s, it placed great emphasis on heroism. In fact, the Hebrew concept, the Israeli concept, takes both these terms, Holocaust and heroism, as if they are two halves of one, which, of course, they are not. The reason is that in the 50s, Israelis just couldn't relate to the Holocaust. They were ashamed of the Holocaust. We were ashamed of the fact that so many people were killed without defending themselves. And so we invented a myth of heroism, which of course, there was some heroism, but its place in the history of the Holocaust is rather marginal, I would say. Now, in the national myth of Israel, we invented that myth of heroism because we needed it very much. And, of course, that also involved looking down at all those victims who did not defend themselves. Over the years, this has changed, and I think most of us have learned to identify with the tragedy of the victims. This is a new development in Israel. I think we don't need heroism so much anymore. I can give you an example. You know, when old Holocaust survivors meet with young people, they always start out by explaining why they couldn't defend themselves, why they weren't heroes. Because they assume that people still accuse them of having victims. And very soon they find out that young people don't ask that question anymore. We don't expect these people to be heroes anymore. We respect them as victims, and we have learned to identify with the tragedy of the victims. I think this is a very dramatic development, really, which is a major theme in my book. And that happened over the last 40 years, but it is a very, very dramatic change in our attitude to the Holocaust. We are no longer ashamed of the Holocaust.
Your parents fled Germany as the Nazis were coming to power. Do you think that that affected your interpretation of the Holocaust and the way you think its place in your thoughts?
Yes, I think it did. I think it did. You know, I grew up speaking German with my mother, really. My father was killed in the 1948 war, Israeli-Arab war. But I grew up speaking German to my mother. She belongs to those immigrants from Germany who never wanted to go to what was then Palestine and is now Israel. And she really feels very much as an immigrant, not to say a refugee in Israel, like all those, or many of those Yekes do. And so obviously I inherited much of her attitude. And in my book, I describe the German immigration to Israel is a very sad story, really. It's not a Zionist success story, as some people describe it, but it is a very sad story because these people would have liked to remain in Germany. They never wanted to come to Israel, and also they never wanted to be transformed into some imaginary new men. This is true, I think, for most immigrants who came to Israel, and this is, of course, not the standard Zionist interpretation of immigration to Israel.
Well, you write that you think some of the Zionists in Palestine looked down on the immigrants who fled Hitler's Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Is that in part based on the perceptions of your parents?
Probably, yes. You know, they spoke German at a time when German shouldn't have been spoken on the streets of Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, and just to give you one example. And it is true for many other immigrants of that time who came, and they were looked down at. And for Holocaust survivors, it was really a big shock. Elie Wiesel just published a review of the 7th Million in the Los Angeles Times, and he describes how he came to Israel in 1949 to write about Holocaust survivors and how shocked he was by the treatment they received there. These people who were victims, and we Israelis were supposed to be heroes. And so we just wouldn't tolerate people who were victims or refugees or anything else than Zionist pioneers. And this is something that has changed.
Well, you said that the immigrants during World War II weren't representative of the new man. What is the place of the new man in Zionist philosophy?
The new man is a Zionist ideal that is based to a large part on the Russian model of the new man, that is supposed to be a person who does not suffer from the weaknesses of the Jewish stereotype, a Jew living in the diaspora. The new man was supposed to defend himself, work the land in his own country, which he would be strong enough and proud enough to protect. It is basically recreating the popular image of the ancient biblical Hebrews in contrast to the Jewish existence in the diaspora, which was considered bad by Zionists, obviously. And so a whole myth was created, and an attempt was made to wipe out 2,000 years of Jewish history and create something new. And this just didn't work because, for one thing, because most Israelis are Jews who came from the diaspora. Most of them did not want to come to Israel, and most of them obviously did not want to give up their Jewish culture. And secondly, a culture that is 2,000 years old is obviously too strong to be wiped out.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Segev, and he's written a new book called The 7th Million, The Israelis and the Holocaust. It's already been published in Israel, where it's been a bestseller. Tom Segev also writes a column on politics and human rights for the Israeli paper Haaretz. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Segev, author of the new book, The 7th Million, The Israelis and the Holocaust. You describe Menachem Begin as the first person who really politicized the Holocaust in Israel.
Yes.
What did he do to politicize it, and what was his personal connection to the Holocaust?
Well, he came to Palestine in 1942. He lost his parents in the Holocaust and most of his family. I think that twice in his political career he used the Holocaust rather cynically. Once, when Israel was about to sign an agreement with Germany concerning reparations for Holocaust victims, in fact that was in the early 50s, at the time when his career, political career, was almost finished, was at a very, very low point, and he discovered that issue as an issue that would bring him back as a popular leader. He staged demonstrations. One of them actually almost stormed. His people were storming the Knesset in Jerusalem, and that was probably the worst point in the history of Israeli democracy. The other time he popularized the Holocaust was what was much, much later, when he was already prime minister, when he identified the chairman of the PLO, Yasser Arafat, with Adolf Hitler. In fact, he said in a letter to President Reagan that he's sending the Israeli army to Beirut to capture Adolf Hitler in his bunker, meaning Yasser Arafat. And this he did again and again. Of course, there's no basis for such a comparison. And he did it quite cynically because he thought it sounds good. So this is an example of someone using the Holocaust, I think, for the wrong purpose.
To play on people's emotions and rally them behind a political agenda.
Yes.
What is the nature of the debate in Israel now on the meaning of the Holocaust?
Israelis today are debating about the lessons to be drawn from the Holocaust. It is a cultural debate, it is a political debate, it is a debate about memory, and it is a debate about identity. It is, in a way, a debate between left and right. The right uses the Holocaust to prove that the entire world is against Israel. Israel is standing alone. It is identifying the Arabs with the Nazis, and it is saying that the Holocaust is there to return at any moment. And consequently, of course, none of the occupied territory should be given back to the Arabs. The left is emphasizing lessons of democracy, protection of human rights, struggle against racism, and other such universal and humanistic lessons to be drawn from the Holocaust. It is a very, very interesting and very deep and very emotional debate that it is going on all the time in Israel today.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not only debating a political issue, it's debating the meaning of the deaths of your family.
Yes, it is also debating the meaning of our collective identity, who we are and who we want to be, and what kind of values do we want to cultivate and what kind of values we don't want to cultivate. So it's a very, very basic debate, all stemming from the Holocaust.
What do you think of the words never again?
They're very profound words. and I think this is the major lesson, of course, to be learned from the Holocaust. Never again. But never again does not only mean never again Auschwitz. It means never again the word tolerating human rights being violated anywhere. I mean, never again has become a very universal command, I think.
How did you learn about the Holocaust when you were growing up? Did you learn about it much from your parents? Did they talk much about the Germany that they had fled? Did you learn about it from books?
I don't think that we really learn about the Holocaust. It's in the air. It's there. There's the Holocaust Day. There's Holocaust. In fact, when I grew up at a time when the Holocaust was not taught in schools. It was very rarely mentioned as part of history lessons or so, because that was a period when we still didn't talk about the Holocaust. So you might say I grew up at a time when the Holocaust was kind of a dark secret for everybody. We knew that it's there, but nobody would talk about it. It's like a dark family secret. And then in the beginning of the 60s, you know, the trial of Adolf Eichmann, that really opened it up for all of us. And that trial served as kind of collective therapy for an entire nation. And then slowly, we began to talk about it and think about it and learn about it. So it came really much, much later.
If you don't mind my asking, I know your father was killed by a Palestinian during the War for Independence in 1988. Did that make you hate all Palestinians?
No. Perhaps the opposite is true. I think it's probably the other round. It made me very much aware of the double tragedy which makes the Israeli experience, both the Jewish tragedy and the Palestinian tragedy. And I think it led me to that side of Israeli politics where people are trying to, where people are willing to pay a high price for peace, including giving up the occupied territories.
Now, how did the death of your father lead you to that conclusion?
Well, because it made me very much aware of the tragedy and what it means. But it could have also worked the other way around. You're right in asking the question. In fact, the Israeli experience shows that personal loss in war leads to the radicalization of views. If somebody had right-wing views, then he becomes usually extreme right-wing. And if he had left-wing or peace movement views, then he becomes more to that direction. But I was 3 years old, so I wasn't thinking politics at that time. But I think that thinking about it over the years probably brought me to the conclusion that we should do everything that other children wouldn't lose their fathers. So I think that's a very natural kind of thought.
You're saying, too, it made you try to empathize with the Palestinians and to try to understand their motivation in the war?
And the, yes,
without... You were talking about the double tragedy.
Yes, of course, without ignoring our own tragedy and our own needs, and without ignoring, for instance, violations of human rights done by Palestinians, both against Israelis and against themselves, as it happens today. So I'm very critical of them as well.
Some people interpret the Holocaust as showing that Jews are subject to more and to the worst oppression, and that that it singles out the Jews. And other people would interpret the Holocaust as yet another really horrible example of the horrors of humanity, that humanity is capable of the worst imaginable crimes. Do you interpret the Holocaust as showing that there is something different and unusual about the oppression of the Jews as compared to the oppression of other groups in the world?
Well, unfortunately, Jewish history shows that Jews have been persecuted more often than others over a period of 2,000 years, and the extermination of the Jews of Europe really is a culmination of that history. At the same time, the Nazis persecuted other people and killed other people. And of course, other Holocausts have occurred since World War II, and I'm using this word because it is not a holy word that you know should be assigned only to the extermination of the Jews, and so of course it is an example of as you said human cruelty.
Tom Segev, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tom Segev is the author of the new book, The Seventh Million: The Israelis and the Holocaust. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, bringing the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Glengarry Glen Ross to the screen. We'll hear from James Foley, who directed the film. It's now out on video. Foley also directed After Dark, My Sweet, and At Close Range. Also, Stephen Schiff reviews Sylvester Stallone's new movie, Cliffhanger. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the House continues debate on President Clinton's plan to cut the nation's deficit and raise taxes. Even though Democratic leaders in the House say they have enough votes to approve the measure, lobbying by the president and vice president continue today. Mr. Clinton is said to have made 35 to 40 telephone calls in the matter. Mr. Clinton's supporters won a test vote this afternoon, 236 to 194. That cleared the way for final consideration of the bill. Republicans have said that they will support no tax increases. A vote is expected later this evening. President Clinton answered questions from some 200 tourists today as part of a live, nationally televised town meeting held in the Rose Garden at the White House. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The president defended his record of the last 4 months, but admitted he'd done a lousy job communicating that record to the country. And for the first time since reports that he'd received a $200 haircut from a Beverly Hills stylist, Mr. Clinton tried to dispel concerns that he'd lost touch with the values of ordinary Americans. He came prepared with a joke. When asked about the haircut, he said, "I just hope no one finds out about the manicure I got in California." And he pointed out that he still wears a $40 watch. The president refused to confirm reports that a staff shakeup was coming at the White House. "There were some glitches. We're going to fix them. Just watch what we do," he said. The president also praised the compromise that was worked out early this morning with conservatives in the House of Representatives, virtually assuring passage there of his budget and deficit reduction plan later today. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Air Force has announced a major shift in its warfighting units. For the first time, B-1B and B-52 heavy bombers will be moved to reserve units. NPR's Martha Raddatz reports these changes will affect bases and personnel all across the country.
The B-1B bomber is the most advanced heavy bomber operated by the Air Force. The entire fleet has always been part of the active duty Air Force, but will now become part of the Air National Guard and Air Force Reserve. The move comes as part of the overall reduction and reorganization of the service, and is due in part to budget cuts. The Office of the Secretary of the Air Force says the change is necessary to achieve operational efficiency and modernize the Air Reserve component. It also means that citizen pilots in the Guard and Reserve will be allowed to fly bombers. But the changes will cause a loss of aircraft and jobs at some bases. Bases in 42 states will be affected, with California seeing the most significant change. 350 active duty positions in that state will be lost. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 15 points to close at a new high of 3,554.83 on volume of 291 million shares. This is NPR News. In Germany, government officials say the nation is going through its worst economic crisis since World War II. Officials have announced big spending cuts in a wide area, including social benefits and subsidies for coal, shipbuilding, and farming. Under efforts to cut some $12 billion from next year's budget, no federal program would go untouched. A spokesman said even a planned move by the German government to Berlin may have to be delayed. While efforts to build up eastern Germany are costing some $60 billion a year, Western Germany is also having economic problems, including a loss of jobs in steel and manufacturing. According to a new study by a consumer group, one out of every five major industrial and governmental facility that uses or treats water have seriously violated the nation's clean water law. NPR's Philip Davis reports.
The U.S. Public Interest Research Group looked at federal data about the nation's 7,000 or so large factories and other facilities from 1990 to 1991. The group found that 40% had illegally poured more pollution into the nation's waterways than they were permitted by the Clean Water Law. The group said violators rarely got more than small fines from the Environmental Protection Agency while saving lots of money by not buying pollution control equipment. The EPA doesn't dispute the group's figures, but the agency says the report ignores the fact that compliance has improved from the 80s and that last year the EPA collected a record $26 million in water pollution fines. The report comes just as Congress is beginning to reauthorize the water law. Some congressmen are calling for tougher penalties for polluters and more inspection powers for the EPA. This is Philip Davis in Washington.
The government says the number of people filing new claims for jobless benefits stayed the same in the latest reporting period. The Labor Department says first-time claims came to 340,000. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Salesmen who don't have a good product to sell rely on persuasive language and lies. David Mamet's Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Glengarry Glen Ross, is about a group of men selling bad real estate to broke customers. These guys have lots of verbal tricks to get customers to buy. They also use their techniques on their boss and on each other to try to get the best customers or the best leads. It's a perfect story for Mamet, who has a great ear for the music of colloquial speech. Glengarry Glen Ross was adapted into a film, which has just come out on video. Mamet wrote the screenplay. My guest James Foley directed the film. He assembled a fine cast, including Al Pacino, Jack Lemmon, Ed Harris, and Alan Arkin. In this scene, Ed Harris and Alan Arkin are talking about what they could do if they had good leads.
You saying a fella, you saying, could take those leads and sell them to Graff?
The leads to Graff, yes. I was saying, yeah, a guy could take, like anything else, it seems to me, that is negotiable, a guy could sell them.
How do you know he'd buy them?
Because I worked for him.
You didn't talk to him?
No. What do you mean? Did I talk to him about this?
Yeah. Are you just talking about this, or are we just talking about it?
Yeah, we're just speaking about it.
Speaking about it as an idea.
Yes.
We're not actually talking about it.
No.
Talking about it as a...
No.
As a robbery.
As a robbery? No.
Well.
Hey.
So all this, you didn't actually call Graff, you didn't talk to him?
Not actually, no.
You didn't?
No, not actually.
Did you?
What did I say?
What did you say?
I said not actually. You care, George. We're just talking.
We are?
Yes.
Because it's a crime.
Robbery. That's right. It is a crime. It's also very safe.
You're actually talking about this.
That's right.
You're going to steal the leads.
Have I said that?
Are you?
Did I say that?
Did you talk to Graff?
What did I say?
What did he say?
What did he say? He'd buy him.
Last fall, we previewed Glengarry Glen Ross in Philadelphia at a benefit screening for WHYY. After the closing credits rolled, I interviewed James Foley in the theater. Foley also directed at Close Range and After Dark, My Sweet.
Thanks for coming. It's great to have you here. The language, as we all heard, is not exactly naturalistic. It's a really kind of stylized, like hyper-realist form of colloquial language. When you're reading the script and figuring out what you want to get out of it as the director, how does a Mamet script read different from what you're used to seeing as a script?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's good, which is very it's very different. And I think the most important thing when I read this screenplay, I certainly was aware of what it was, and I really began to read it with some trepidation, like, why do I want to make a film out of this Pulitzer Prize-winning play? It was not something I ever saw myself doing. And so I read it with, not likely. But what really surprised me was that the reading of it seemed much more emotionally accessible than my memory of the play. I had thought when I saw the play that it really appealed to me sort of from the neck up and was an interesting intellectual, philosophical, black, humorous sort of experience. But reading the screenplay, for some reasons that I later analyzed for myself, it really opened up a whole nother level of an emotional accessibility to the characters that had not been evident for me on stage.
Did you want people to read the lines naturalistically, or were you looking for something else?
No, that was very important, because I became aware early on that there was a real danger that actors could get into with language like this, where they get seduced by the superficial level of gratification that comes from just saying good dialogue that's written in a rhythmic way. Because if you just memorize the lines and say them fast, they sound good. And so one could get convinced that it actually meant something. And that actually happened a lot when we had actors come in to read, and some really heavyweight actors had come in and read. And they made a big mistake by sort of having prepared in that superficial way. And so it was flashy and entertaining, but totally boring to me. What I was much more interested in was getting actors who had an interior emotional life that was easily accessible. And I felt as if the technical aspects of being able to fire off this rapid dialogue was something that would come later, but it was secondary to me to this internal life, and an internal life specific to cinema actors.
The casting is terrific in the film, but it seems to me you've brought together actors with really different kinds of acting styles. You have Jack Lemmon, who's a kind of like naturalistic actor, and Al Pacino's Al Pacino,
I was going to sit and wait until you get an adjective for each guy.
Yeah. But Ed Harris is kind of chameleon-like in a way, and he can really like blend into a role. But they're, I don't know, like Lemmon's of a different generation than a lot of actors in there, both in terms of his age, but also in terms of his style. And I was wondering if you consciously picked people with different acting styles and what it was like to work with people who, it seems to me, probably take really different approaches to their characters.
There was certainly no intention to deliberately pick people with different styles. It was really, Al and I literally sat down and made a list of who we thought were the best living actors, without even regards to what parts they could play, how old they were. Who do we think is great? And the list isn't that long, you know, when you sit down and just say who's the best. And we started from that idea and wound up with these guys. And it's very true that they all have very different styles of acting, and it was a great fun for me particularly when they were all in the scene together, and you know, you say cut, and then you need to go out and speak to each one of them, and I'd find myself instinctually sort of speaking an entirely different language to each one, which was nice, because it made me sort of really expand my own idea of what it means to be a director. And you know, for me, the most important thing is to do what needs to be done rather than what you want to do.
So you needed to speak a different language to each of the actors?
Totally, yes.
Okay, and so what would you tell Jack Lemmon as opposed to Al Pacino, as opposed to
instance,
Ed Harris?
Well, for instance, Jack Lemmon will speak very clearly about the thing quite literally, the thing being what's going on at the moment that... And perhaps the most telling thing is that when Jack would talk about the character, he would say he would say, I think he's feeling this because of this and blah, 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 and say whole articulate sentences. Al would never speak like that, because first of all, he would say I, referring to something, but he would never talk about any kind of singular idea or notion. And something that I understand very much, because if you articulate a single idea that's happening, then you might try, you know, you might sort of glom onto that in too much of a specific way rather than letting all the contradictions and ambivalences that might naturally come out. So he's very reluctant to identify any one particular feeling, and even reluctant to finish a sentence. But I began to understand very well what he was talking about, and I agreed with him. So our communication was more like him saying, I think, you know, maybe, you know, and I'd say, yeah, right, more so, blah, blah, blah. And we somehow did it, and even to the point where it got to, you know, where once we had done enough takes where we both felt like we really had it, we would always do one crazy one. And that's, we would just call it a crazy one, because to try something just that was a stupid idea, but it's amazing how many of the crazy ones are in there.
We're listening to an interview with James Foley, director of the film Glengarry Glen Ross, which has just come out on video. Time for a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
We're featuring an interview with James Foley, director of the film Glengarry Glen Ross. Our interview was recorded in a movie theater after a screening of the film.
When you were rehearsing for this, did you bring in any real salesmen to give a sense of how they do it, to talk about their spiels?
Yeah, we did. Somehow somebody dug up a real guy who came in, who was great. He read the script and was thrilled by it and was very proud that we were making a film about him. and he really was very... he was a good sort of visitor because he thought it was very authentic down to every detail, and that gave everybody encouragement. What was interesting about him was that he had no consciousness whatsoever that there was any irony about the situation. He just thought it was a very good story about these guys and showed how sort of clever they were and stuff like that, and he thought it was quite glamorous. And that was very good because the guys at this point during the rehearsals really needed to connect to that, you know, because they needed to, of course, you know, not see anything ironic about it themselves and, you know, let that take care of it and had to become totally and find some pride in being one of these guys because, you know, they all are, particularly Ricky Roma being the top of the heap. You know, he was very proud, Al, of his pinky ring. He was always looking at it and sort of happy with his suit that cost $2,000. And he would, like, you know, like he does, get into it.
When you're directing a movie in which all the actors in it are playing the part of somebody who's very aggressive and in selling, are they that way when you're trying to direct them? Was it intimidating at all because mm-hmm. they're all playing these really manipulative people who have their raps and they have their ways?
No, it was, which has been my experience really on every film, that actors really, really want to be directed and they want interaction.
Even the big stars?
Well, that's what's great is that, you know, it doesn't matter who it is. You know, they just, and I really think the best actors, I mean, you know, like Al and the rest of the guys, are so interested in trying anything that they very much want a reaction. And what was interesting, as you said before, is that each person wants that reaction in a different way. I mean, some people don't want you to say certain things, and other people do want you to say certain things. And that's the fun part, is this instinctual idea of figuring out what it is that they need at what time, including sometimes being a little bit pushing a little bit more than they might want at the time. But there's a mutual understanding of what you're doing.
Who did you push?
Oh, I push them all at different times in different ways, you know, but it's just, it's all different how you push them. Because sometimes pushing just means, let's do another take right now, really fast. And they go, well, wait. And you say, no, it has to be really fast because, you know, we're really in, and you sort of discombobulate them on purpose because you feel like perhaps we're getting into a kind of a rut and it's getting too precious and people are getting too conscious of what they're saying and you want to. And I've taken to do weird things like, you know, I demand silence all the time from everybody on the crew and everything. I'm always barking about that. And then I get total silence. And then when it's ready to go, I scream, cut, not cut. What do I scream? Action. One of those two things. Just scream, action, like as loud as I can, which is like really startling. And then the actor's got to start saying his line. But it's sort of like sometimes you see them standing there and they're getting too much into a plan of what they're going to do. And you want them to forget their plan and let whatever happens going to happen. And so it's all different things of doing. I actually threw a fit once, a fake fit, yelling at somebody on the crew just to, you know, get the actors out of their lethargy and change the mood, the electricity on the set.
Was the crew member in on the fact
yes.
that this is a fake fit?
Yes. Yes, I made sure I did that.
So what were you throwing the fit about?
I was throwing the fit about people talking, because I'm famous for throwing fits, real fits, because people will not shut up. So I asked this one guy to talk, right, so then I could turn around and scream at him. It worked.
Did it get what you wanted?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So what did it get you doing this?
It got me the actors being more immediate, that the thing you always have to fight, you know, on take 11 is that people doing the exact same thing, and it begins to become, they begin to remember that they just did it before, and so there's a repetition, an inevitable repetition. So it's almost like this feeling you have, you know, when all of a sudden in the middle of the day the weather changes dramatically, and it goes from being sunny and calm, and then wind is coming, and you feel your whole mood and everything change. And you've got to sort of change the weather on the set sometimes.
You're friends with Sean Penn, and you've directed him in a movie. Is it harder to direct a friend than an actor who you admire and you don't know at all, or vice versa, or no correlation?
I don't think I would ever start to do a movie with the lead actors. I didn't have some kind of personal relationship with them and know them well enough. I mean, my litmus test is I have to be able to make fun of them and make fun of who they are and of their fame. It's very important to sort of feel as if that's a joke, and no, we don't care about that. And in Sean's case, I knew him a lot. You know, we were very good friends. And it creates a very positive opportunity because you know somebody very well and becomes very sort of private, and you can be very specifically emotional. And there's just that thing that friends have where you don't have to have any kind of formality about it. The flip side, however, is something that always interests me, but I've gotten a lot better about, is that you have your own emotional life that's going on during the movie. And sometimes you get in a position where you have to, it's not equal, because the actor is doing what they're doing and they're using their emotions. And in a certain way, you are in a very, in emotional movies, you're creating an environment where they can express their emotions, and that's the most important thing. And their emotions are more important than your emotions during that time, because, you got to get on with it and you do that. And sometimes, you get your feelings hurt, but you can't, stop the movie because somebody hurt your feelings, but it happens to be like a very good friend of yours. And so in different times, that can be something where my own persecution complex can like well up, and I feel like, why is God punishing me by making me do this? But there's less of that the more movies I do.
Listen, it's been wonderful to have you here, and it's been wonderful to get the kind of insights that you could give us into this film and into filmmaking in general. So thank you very, very much for being here.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
James Foley directed Glengarry Glen Ross, which has just come out on video. Our interview was recorded at the Riverview Movie Theater in Philadelphia after a screening of the film. By the way, for all of you David Mamet fans, you're probably also fans of W.H. Macy. Tomorrow we'll feature an interview with Macy, who has starred in and directed Mamet's work and developed an acting technique with him. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll report on President Clinton's deficit reduction program in the House of Representatives. Also in Texas, the Senate there has approved a school bill to equalize funding between rich and poor school districts. The Mexican government is now reported to have spent more than $30 million to lobby the U.S. Congress to approve the North American Free Trade Agreement. And I'll talk with Ana Castillo. She's written a novel about present-day New Mexico, about Sophie and her four daughters and their troubled stories. One was mutilated by evil forces, one became a television reporter and disappeared, one died of cancer, and one died as a child and was then resurrected.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The unknown Finnish director Reni Harlin became a name to reckon with in Hollywood in 1990 when he made a high-profile flop called The Adventures of Fort Fairlane, starring Andrew Dice Clay, and then immediately after had a high-profile hit with Die Hard 2. Did all that prepare him to direct Sylvester Stallone on a mountaintop? Film critic Stephen Schiff took a look at Cliffhanger.
In Hollywood, they're always trying to quantify how much the audience wants to see an upcoming film. There's even a typically subtle Hollywood term for that unknown quantity. It's called want to see. Now, by my reckoning, the want to see on Cliffhanger must be dinky. I mean, mountain movies have never been big box office. And Sylvester Stallone? You mean coming off the fantastic success of his last picture, Stop or My Mom Will Shoot? Yet, I predict that Cliffhanger is going to be the third biggest hit of the summer after Jurassic Park and The Last Action Hero. Why? Well, mainly because it works. This is an idiotic movie with a terrible script and lame performances, but it's a pretty effective thrill machine. And that's because Reni Harlin has concentrated on a single primal emotion, an emotion that combines excitation and terror in an almost sexual way, the fear of heights. The movie begins with a spectacular sequence in which a mountain climber named Gabe, played by Sylvester Stallone, botches the rescue of his best friend's girl. And naturally, that best friend, Hal, a rescuer himself, can't forgive him. Gabe retreats to the big city, leaving behind his girlfriend, Jessie, who's also on the rescue squad. Then, after a year of wrestling with his conscience, he returns to romance her away. But his timing is bad. A big storm is brewing. There are folks out there who need help. And they've just phoned in an SOS to the rescue station, where Jessie, played by Janine Turner, is in command.
We just got an emergency call. Five climbers are stranded off Combe Bluff. The weather's pouring in, and Hal's gone up alone.
Oh, Hal's a good climber.
What? What's that supposed to mean?
It means he can handle it himself.
If he gets up there and gets sucked in by the weather, they'll never make it down. Gabe, he needs someone who has emergency medical training and knows every handle of those peaks.
I know I'm the last one he wants help from, and that's not what I came back here for.
Our problems are not the issue right now. Those people are. What if he can't do it alone?
Look, Jessie, I haven't climbed in months. You just lose the feel.
Maybe you mean the nerve.
Is the script that bad all the way through? Yes. Is the acting that stiff? Uh-huh. And does the movie follow that scene's cornball lead and turn into a kind of Rocky Mountain Rocky, with Stallone struggling to recover his nerve in time for the big finish? Fortunately, no. This picture is nothing but good guys versus bad guys. The people out there who need rescuing turn out to be a villainous gang of international thieves led by evil John Lithgow. Their plane has crashed, and now they're combing the mountains to retrieve three suitcases full of $1,000 bills. And their rescuers are being forced to help them out at gunpoint. Yes, I was bothered by the idea that those $1,000 bills had just been made at the Denver Mint, especially since the Denver Mint produces only coins, not bills. And yes, I was bothered by some of the movie's more moronic stunts. And by the way, Rennie Harlan tries to wring horror and pathos out of them by resorting to cheesy slow motion wherever he can. But the moronic stunts are always followed by sharp and scary ones. And the swooping shots of vertiginous cliffs and bottomless crevices never stop feeling astonishing. With no characters, a dumb story, no clever twists, and no subtlety whatsoever, Cliffhanger is an experience you can't possibly respect as long as you think of it as a film. But think of it as a roller coaster, and you might find yourself having a pretty good time.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a lesson in acting from actor and director W.H. Macy. We talk with Macy about the acting techniques he developed with David Mamet. Macy has starred in Mamet films and theatrical productions, and co-founded the Atlantic Theater Company. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.